Welcome back to the Hemingway List. Excuse me. The podcast where we do things the Hemingway. In today's episode, we will be discussing Book 3, Chapter 3 of The Brothers Karamazov and reading Book 3, Chapter 4. The questions that I asked you guys about Book 3, Chapter 3 were, well, a little bit embarrassing because I was so clearly frustrated at the end of yesterday's chapter. Still frustrated that, I just find this book so hard to, not hard to read, just hard to, like, enjoy. Like, the first two chapters of Book 3 were great. They were, like, normal pace, normal storytelling, normal dialogue. And then we flip back to these weird brothers and, like, Grigory and Fyodor, Grigory's wife to some extent, and that stinky Lisa girl. Also the, what's his name? The Zosimo or whatever. Those characters have a bit of a personality to some extent. Grigory has got a pretty strong personality. Fyodor does. But as soon as you saw Alyosha, or Mitya, or Dmitri, or Ivan, those names mean nothing to me. Like, I know some of them are the brothers. I don't know which three of those are the brothers, but three of those are the brothers. But they're just blank. Like, I can't picture them at all. I can't even tell you an age within 25 years. Like, Alyosha might be 14. He might be 38. I do not know. I have no picture in my head of who he is. And same with his two brothers, whoever they are. I think it's Ivan and Dmitri, which is Mitya. They're the same. Anyway, they're just blank. And I know Alyosha is like the religious one, and one of them, the other ones, is like the smart one, and one of them is like another thing, like hot-headed or something like that. But I only know that because, like, that's what was described sort of thing, but they're just blank. They're just blank, nothing characters to me. And then their dialogue, whenever it's those guys talking, and they just talk in, like, seriously, like, 800 to 1,000 word chunks. It's like they're recording a podcast to each other, right? Like, I haven't even said that many words yet in this podcast. And it's like, it's meant to be them having a conversation. But no conversation I've ever had has just had one guy talk for, like, seriously 6 or 7 minutes straight, where the other person just stands there and look. Like, where would you even look at the other person while they were doing that? Like, would you have eye contact? Or would you, like, just go about your business while they, like, follow you around the room, continuing their talk? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, the questions that I asked out of all that frustration were this. The only thing I can tell you about this chapter is that Mitya and Alyosha were in it. I don't know who those two are. I think Alyosha is the religious Karamazov and Mitya is someone else. What are they talking about? What is their topic? Was there a topic to the conversation? And was this chapter about something? What were they talking about? It's like, not even that question. It's like, what were they trying to talk about? Like, because they say, like, 3 pages, and at the end of this 3-page diatribe that the guy says, apparently in conversation with another person, I couldn't even tell you if there was a topic to those 3 pages. Like, it's just so many words and not actually saying anything that sinks in. And I know that's on me, guys, because I know it makes sense, and I know other people are enjoying it and following it, but for me, I just can't, like, it's just not sinking in. Techrific, dude, you're the best. His comment starts, "Let's help Ander out, folks." And I appreciate that. I do need help. I feel like, because the worst thing is that I know everyone else is fine with this, and I seem to be the only one who's just, like, baffled. And so I'm just getting the feeling, like, I might be too dumb for this book. That might be all it comes down to. My translation basically lays it all out in the chapter heading, Confessions of a Passionate Heart, in verse. So, Alyosha takes on the role of father confessor when he meets his brother, Mitya, Dmitry, on his way to Katerina Ivanovna. Okay, I don't know what a father confessor is. I don't know which brother Alyosha is or Mitya, and I don't know who Katerina Ivanovna is. The passionate heart, it turns out, is Mitya's. As I suspected, it turns out that Mitya is a believer and a drama within Mitya. Using his own words, the Madonna and Sodom is taking place. He blames beauty, the terrible beauty that tempts a man's heart. On a side note, I think we can think of the heart here as a stand-in for the mind. Alyosha spoke about the idea of meeting Katerina as inducing a sudden torment in his heart. I don't think he was lovesick, so heart basically means mind. Mitya is driven towards sexual promiscuity and he can't stop himself and is asking his brother for advice in a roundabout manner befitting their class and in tune with the Russian spirit of the time. So Mitya is torn between what he knows is the right thing and his proclivity towards beauty, as he puts it, i.e. sin. Old Dosto throws in a lot of old German romantic poetry by the giants of the field, Goethe and Schiller, the old Sturm and Drang guard, to add weights to Mitch's words and feelings. Dosto also alludes to Pushkin's The Tale of the Fisherman and the Golden Fish story, which basically is a morality tale against greed, or perhaps more aptly put, be careful what you wish for. Alyosha desperately wants to help his brother, but is unsure of what he can actually do or say in order to effect any real change in his brother's tormented state. That's basically it. Swim said the mum of fish, he said, I had to look up definitions of the heart. There are a myriad. I think Dostoevsky used heart based on these definitions. The emotional or moral nature as distinguished from the intellectual nature, one's innermost character, feelings or inclinations. I think Dostoevsky did mean heart, not mind. I agree. I get what Tech is saying from a modern way of thinking, but Dostoevsky was coming at it from his romantic perspective. Part of the thing is that the K brothers is that they all have their sensualist side, a feeling side, a non-rational side, one driven by the heart, as people of that era saw it. It reflects the subjective side and is the opposite of the more level-headed objective side. It is why they have so much drama in their family, because their sensualist side overpowers their calmer, more objective sides. Laura Y. Stitch said, also some people, i.e. Ander, maybe also be getting confused by Dosto's use of multiple names for the characters. In this chapter, Dmitry is Mitya and Alexei is Alyosha. Yeah, I picked up that Alexei was Alyosha, but I didn't realize Dmitry was Mitya. I mean, I think I did know that earlier on in the book, but I just forgot because the characters are just like paper cutouts of shapes. They're not really anything that resemble human people to me yet. Yeah, I don't know, they're so bland that I just forgot whose name was what. Techrific said, I'll just add that Mitya can also be called Mitenka, Mitka, and Mitri, and Ivan is also Vanya and Vanichka. Alexei is Alexei, can be called not only Alyosha, but Alyoshenka, Alyoshka, Alyoshka, Lyoshenka, and Katerina can be Katya, Katenka, Katka. Mikhail is also Misha. Grushenka can also be Grushka and Grusha. Cool. They're all stand-ins for each other anyway. So I'm trying to get them straight in my head. But Alyosha is the religious one. That's pretty much... And Fyodor is the dad who's like a total douchebag. Soma Stars says, Dmitry is confessing in this chapter and the next two, judging by the chapter names. But I'm left wondering if he's confessing to something that has happened or if he's confessing his sensualist side that is going to drive him to do something. Radikin felt that Dmitry was going to kill Fyodor. Is this a precursor to a murder? Are we seeing Dmitry's sensualist side taking over, leading him to lose control and go a little crazy? So he's just kind of lusting and he's passionate. He's being passionate and he's not thinking rationally. There you go. I saved you 15 minutes of reading. Radikin said, Radikin felt that Dmitry was going to kill Fyodor. Is this a precursor to murder? Terrific said, I would and will hate this whole book if Dosto granted Radikin the role of truth-teller in this story. I'm nursing some hopes of seeing Radikin sent off to Siberia. We know that Fyodor Pavlovich is destined to die, but I hope and trust it's not Mitya in the role of murderer. Question 1, Norwegian said, the only thing I can tell you about this chapter is Mitya and Alyosha are in it. Don't know who they are. When Alyosha joined Zosima outside of his hermitage to meet the peasant woman, Lisa and her mother were among the crowd. Lisa hands Alyosha a letter telling him to meet Katerina Ivanovna. Lisa then comments that Katerina has endured and will face much suffering. We also find out in this chapter that Lisa is the daughter of Madame Holokov. So Lisa Holokov. Okay, I remember those characters out the front. Outside the hermitage. Question 2 and 3, what were they talking about? Is there some point to the conversation? I think Dmitri is a little drunk with how quickly he talks about love and bursts into poetry and the mention of brandy, obviously. And that the discussion, more than anything, is just about Dmitri struggling with himself, sunk in vilest degradation, man, his loathsomeness displays. He wanted to talk to Alyosha because he would not forgive him, and forgiveness from him would mean something. The chapter deepens. Dmitri sets up Alyosha's conversation with Katerina Ivanovna. Alyosha's axiomatic assumption that nobody would or ever could hurt him comes off as a Chekhov's gun. I wonder if it's naivety. All the people close to him having told him all his life that nobody could hurt him because of his good nature. The more we learn about Dmitri, the more I like him. He lacks the moral compass Alyosha has, or at least the ability to follow it. He seems to be suffering from something like existential angst. Truth about human nature are coming crashing down on him, and he is unable to reconcile them. He says in several ways that he doesn't know how to navigate his understanding of the world, that he is caught in contradictory dilemmas. He keeps cursing not himself, but his nature, or the nature of man, and his inability to rise above it. At least that's how I read it. Samostar says she is Lisa Holokov, but Madame Holokov is her mum. Lisa is the partly paralyzed girl in the wheelchair, and her mum was the one that was the woman that truly wanted to believe in God, but just couldn't. Sooner Time said, sorry to ask this here, but is there a discussion for something like this for Crime and Punishment? I'm working my way through it and I would like some input. Hey, that would be cool. I don't think there's any more Dostoevsky on this list, but we are going to be doing Anna Karenina. So that's coming around at some point. That's Tolstoy, but, you know, same thing. I think it's the dialogue that's doing me in here. Like in the previous chapter, they were drunk, which made it even more obnoxious, but already they were talking like, I don't know, it was just like someone who was like whacked off their face on cocaine or having some kind of manic episode where they just talk and talk and talk and talk and they're not saying anything. And like, if someone was talking to me like that in real life, I'd be like, dude, I think you're having like a panic attack. Do you want me to, should I call an ambulance? Because you've just said like 7 minutes worth of words straight. And it was just this jumbled, garbled thing with a vague topic. You even said two poems in that sentence, that last thing that you said. You just said two poems to me before I even responded. And not back to back with like paragraphs in between. I'm dialing for an ambulance. That would be my honest response. I'm starting to see why Hemingway's had that thing about Dostoevsky, like, what was it? Like, for such a bad writer, he's such a good writer or something like that. I'm feeling like I'm starting to understand why he would say something like that. All right, cool. Enough bitching. Fingers crossed that this next chapter is normal words, normal sentences. And let's jump into it. Book 3, Chapter 4, The Confessions of a Passionate Heart, in anecdote. So he's continuing. And I've just noticed that it starts with some quotation marks. So let me just, as a marker, tell you where this first thing that he's saying, before the other guy responds, starts. And let's see. Just imagine while I say this that you're having a conversation, like you're standing opposite someone and they're talking. It's their turn to talk and you're going to respond when they finish. And this is what they say. I was leading a wild life then. Father said just now that I spent several thousand rubles in seducing young girls. That's a swinish invention, and there was nothing of the sort. And if there was, I didn't need money simply for that. With me, money is an accessory, the overflow of my heart, the framework. Today, she would be my lady, tomorrow, a wench out of the streets in her place. I entertained them both. I threw away money by the handful on music, rioting, and gypsies. Sometimes I gave it to the ladies, too, for they'll take it greedily, that must be admitted, and be pleased and thankful for it. Ladies used to be fond of me, not all of them, but it happened. But I always liked side paths, little dark black back alleys behind the main road. There one finds adventure and surprises, and precious metal in the dirt. I am speaking figuratively, brother. In the town I was, there were no such back alleys, in the literal sense, but morally there were. If you were like me, you'd know what that means. I loved vice. I loved the ignominy of vice. I loved cruelty. Am I not a bug? Am I not a noxious insect? In fact, a Karamazov. Once we went, a whole lot of us, for a picnic in several sledges. It was dark. It was winter. And I began squeezing a girl's hand and forced her to kiss me. She was the daughter of an official, a sweet, gentle, submissive creature. She allowed me, much in the dark. It says that twice. She allowed me, much in the dark. She thought, poor thing, that I should come next day to make her an offer. I was looked upon as a good match, too. But I didn't say a word to her for 5 months. I used to see her in a corner at dances. We were always having dances, her eyes watching me. I saw how they glowed with fire, a fire of gentle indignation. This game only tickled that insect lust I cherished in my soul. 5 months later, she married an official and left town, still angry and still perhaps in love with me. Now they live happily. Observe that I told no one. I didn't boast of it. Though I am full of low desires and love what's low, I'm not dishonorable. You're blushing. Your eyes flashed. Enough of this filth with you. And all this was nothing much. Wayside blossoms a la Paul de Kock. Though the cruel insect had already grown strong in my soul. I've a perfect album of reminiscences, brother. God bless them, the darlings. I tried to break it off without quarrelling, and I never gave them away. I never bragged of one of them. But that's enough. You can't suppose I brought you here simply to talk of such nonsense. No, I'm going to tell you something more curious, and don't be surprised that I'm glad to tell you instead of being ashamed. You say that because I blushed, Alyosha said suddenly. I wasn't blushing at what you were saying or what you've done. I blushed because I am the same as you are. So that was Alyosha. That was Alyosha's time to speak. You see what I mean? That was a relatively short one compared to last chapter, but it's just... I don't know. It's killing me. No one speaks like that. you... Come, that's going a little too far. No, it's not too far, said Alyosha warmly. Obviously, the idea was not a new one. The ladder's the same. I'm at the bottom step, and you're above, somewhere about the 13th. That's how I see it. But it's all the same, absolutely, and it's the same in kind. Anyone on the bottom step is bound to go up to the top one. Then one ought not to step on at all. Anyone who can't help it had better not. But can you? I think not. What are they talking about, a ladder? I'm not following. Hush, Alyosha, hush, darling. I could kiss your hand. You touch me so. That rogue Grushenka has an eye for men. She told me once that she'd devour you one day. There, I won't. From this field of corruption fouled by flies, let's pass to my tragedy, also befouled by flies, that is, by every sort of vileness. Although the old man tells lies about my seducing innocence, there really was something of the sort in my tragedy, though it was only once, and then it did not come off. The old man who has reproached me with that what never happened does not even know of this fact. I never told anyone about it. You're the first, except Ivan, of course. Ivan knows everything. He knew about it long before you, but Ivan's a tomb. Ivan's a tomb? Alyosha listened with great attention. I was lieutenant in a line regiment, but still I was under supervision, like a kind of convict. Yet I was awfully well received in the little town. I spent money right and left. I was thought to be rich. I thought so myself, but I must have pleased them in other ways as well. Although they shook their heads over me, they liked me. My colonel, who was an old man, took a sudden dislike to me. He was always down upon me, but I had powerful friends, and moreover, all the town was on my side, so he couldn't do me much harm. I was in fault myself for refusing to treat him with proper respect. I was proud. The obstinate old fellow, who was really a very good sort, kind-hearted and hospitable, had had two wives, both dead. His first wife, who was of a humble family, left a daughter as unpretentious as herself. She was a young woman of 24 when I was there, and was living with her father and an aunt, her mother's sister. The aunt was simple and illiterate. The niece was simple but lively. I like to say nice things about people. I never knew a woman of more charming character than Agafya. Fancy, her name was Agafya Ivanovna, and she wasn't bad looking either, in the Russian style, tall, stout, with a full figure and beautiful eyes, though a rather coarse face. She had not married, although she had had two suitors. She refused them, but was as cheerful as ever. I was intimate with her, not in that way, it was pure friendship. I have often been friendly with women quite innocently. I used to talk to her with shocking frankness, and she only laughed. Many women like such freedom, and she was a girl, too, which made it very amusing. Another thing one could never think of her as a young lady. She and her aunt lived in her father's house with a sort of voluntary humility, not putting themselves on an equality with other people. She was a general favourite, and of use of everyone, for she was a clever dressmaker. She had a talent for it. She gave her services freely, without asking for payment, but if anyone offered her payment, she didn't refuse. The colonel, of course, was a different, very different matter. He was one of the chief personages in the district. He kept open house, entertained the whole town, gave suppers and dances. At the time I arrived and joined the battalion, all the town was talking of the expected return of the colonel's second daughter, a great beauty, who had just left a fashionable school in the capital. The second daughter is Katerina Ivanovna, and she was the child of the second wife, who belonged to a distinguished general's family, although as I learned on good authority, she too brought the colonel no money. She had connections, and that was all. There may have been expectations, but they had come to nothing. Yet when the young lady came from boarding school on a visit, the whole town revived. Our most distinguished ladies, two excellencies and a colonel's wife, and all the rest following their lead, at once took her up and gave entertainments in her honour. She was the belle of the balls and picnics, and they got up tableaux vivants in aid of distressed governesses. I took no notice. I went on as wildly as before, and one of my exploits at the time set all the town talking. I saw her eyes taking my measure one evening at the battery commander's, but I didn't go up to her, as though I disdained her acquaintance. I did go up and speak to her at an evening party, not long after. She scarcely looked at me and compressed her lips scornfully. "Wait a bit, I'll have my revenge," thought I. I behaved like an awful fool on many occasions at that time, and I was conscious of it myself. What made it worse was that I felt that Katenka was not an innocent boarding school miss, but a person of character, proud and really high-principled above all. She had education and intellect, and I had neither. You think I meant to make her an offer? No, I simply wanted to revenge myself because I was such a hero, and she didn't seem to feel it. Meanwhile, I spent my time in drink and riot till the lieutenant colonel put me under arrest for 3 days. Just at that time, Father sent me 6,000 rubles in return for my sending him a deed, giving up all claims upon him, settling our accounts, so to speak, and saying that I wouldn't expect anything more. I didn't understand a word of it at the time, until I came here, Alyosha, till the last few days, indeed, perhaps even now. I haven't been able to make head or tails of my money affairs with Father, but never mind that, we'll talk of it later. Just as I received the money, I got a letter from a friend telling me something that interested me immensely. The authorities, I learned, were dissatisfied with our lieutenant colonel. He was suspected of irregularities. In fact, his enemies were preparing a surprise for him. And then the commander of the division arrived and kicked up the devil of a shindy. Shortly afterwards, he was ordered to retire. I won't tell you how it all happened. He had enemies, certainly. Suddenly, there was a marked coolness in the town towards him and all his family. His friends all turned their backs on him. Then I took my first step. I met Agafya Ivanovna, with whom I'd always kept up a friendship, and said, "Do you know there's a deficit of 4,500 rubles of government money in your father's accounts?" "What do you mean? What makes you say so? The general was here not long ago, and everything was all right." "Then it was, but now it isn't." She was terribly scared. "Don't frighten me," she said. "Who told you so?" "Don't be uneasy," I said. "I won't tell anyone. You know I'm as silent as a tomb. I only wanted in view of possibilities, to add that when they demand that 4,500 rubles from your father, and he can't produce it, he'll be tried and made to serve as a common soldier in his old age, unless you like to send me your young lady secretly. I've just had money paid me. I'll give her 4,000 if you like, and keep the secret religiously." "Ah, you scoundrel," that's what she said. "You wicked scoundrel, how dare you?" She went away furiously indignant, while I shouted after her once more that the secret should be kept sacred. Those two simple creatures, Agafya and her aunt, I may as well say at once, behaved like perfect angels all through this business. They genuinely adored their catcher, thought her far above them, and waited on her hand and foot, but Agafya told her of our conversation. I found that out afterwards. She didn't keep it back, and of course that was all I wanted. Suddenly the new major arrived to take command of the battalion. The old lieutenant colonel was taken ill at once, couldn't leave his room for 2 days, and didn't hand over the government money. Dr. Kravchenko declared that he was really ill, but I knew for a fact, and had known for a long time, that for the last 4 years the money had never been in his hands except when the commander made his visits of inspection. He used to lend it to a trustworthy person, a merchant of our town called Trifonov, an old widower, with a big beard and gold-rimmed spectacles. He used to go to the fair, do a profitable business with the money, and return the whole sum to the colonel, bringing with it a present from the fair, as well as interest on the loan. But this time, I heard all about it quite by chance from Trifonov's son and heir, a drivelling youth, and one of the most vicious in the world. This time, I say, Trifonov brought nothing back from the fair. The lieutenant colonel flew to him. "I've never received any money from you, and couldn't possibly have received any." That was all the answer he got. So now our lieutenant colonel is confined to the house, with a towel around his head, while they're all three busy putting ice on it. All at once, an orderly arrives on the scene with the book and the order to hand over the battalion money immediately, within 2 hours. He signed the book. I saw the signature in the book afterwards. Stood up, saying he would put on his uniform, ran to his bedroom, loaded his double-barreled gun with a service bullet, took the boot off his right foot, fixed the gun against his chest, and began feeling for the trigger with his foot. But Agafya, remembering what I had told her, had her suspicions. She stole up and peeped into the room just in time. She rushed in, flung herself upon him from behind, threw her arms around him, and the gun went off, hit the ceiling, but hurt no one. The others ran in, took away the gun, and held him by the arms. I heard all about this afterwards. I was at home. It was getting dusk, and I was just preparing to go out. I had dressed, brushed my hair, scented my handkerchief, and taken my cap, when suddenly the door opened, and facing me in the room stood Katerina Ivanovna. It's strange how things happen sometimes. No one had seen her in the street, so that no one knew of it in the town. I lodged with two decrepit old ladies who looked after me. They were most obliging old things, ready to do anything for me, and at my request were as silent afterwards as two cast-iron pots. Of course I grasped the position at once. She walked in and looked straight at me, her dark eyes determined, even defiant, but on her lips and round mouth I saw uncertainty. "My sister told me," she began, "that you would give me 4,500 rubles if I came to you for it myself. I have come. Give me the money." She couldn't keep it up. She was breathless, frightened. Her voice failed her, and the corners of her mouth and the lines around it quivered. "Alyosha, are you listening or are you asleep?" "Mitya, I know you will tell the whole truth," said Alyosha in agitation. So that was all one thing, just to pause for a second, that went for like, I don't know, like 3.5 pages. But here it's kind of lapsed into him being like a narrator of an anecdote. He's telling a story. Almost like how we had, like, nearly the whole narration of Wuthering Heights was a character telling another a story. And at that point, it's not realistic dialogue, but it's almost like narration, and that's kind of fine, that's effective. And that's what's happened here. They've lapsed into narration rather than dialogue through dialogue. But wasn't he drunk and excited and agitated just a minute ago? And, like, spilling all these, like, sentences and repeating himself over and over, like, saying all these sentences where he'd repeat himself because of his drunken agitatedness. And now, suddenly, he's, like, this perfectly smooth narrator. Like, the last 3.5 pages have actually been quite smooth and refined narration, which is fine. But 1 second ago, this character was belligerent. Anyway, let me continue. "Mitcha, I know you will tell the whole truth," said Alyosha in agitation. "I am telling it. If I tell the whole truth just as it happened, I shan't spare myself. My first idea was as a Karamazov one. Once I was bitten by a centipede, brother, and I laid up a fortnight with fever from it. Well, I felt a centipede biting at my heart then, a noxious insect, you understand?" You see, he's lapped right back into his belligerent. Like, that's a completely different person speaking from that whole 3-page narration. "I looked her up and down. You've seen her? She's a beauty. But she was beautiful in another way then. At that moment, she was beautiful because she was noble, and I was a scoundrel. She, in all the grandeur of her generosity and sacrifice of her father, and I a bug. And scoundrel as I was, she was altogether at my mercy, body and soul. She was hemmed in. I tell you frankly, that thought, that venomous thought, so possessed my heart that it almost swooned with suspense." See, why is he now being all repetitive and jerky and like his words are all befuddled? And just a minute ago, this is a bad book. I'm just like calling it right now. This is a bad book. I don't know, maybe it's the translator or something. "I tell you frankly that thought, that venomous thought, so possessed my heart that it almost swooned with suspense. It seemed as if there could be no resisting it, as though I should act like a bug, like a venomous spider without a spark of pity. I could scarcely breathe. Understand, I should have gone next day to ask for her hand so that it might end honourably, so to speak, and that nobody would or could know. For though I'm a man of base desires, I'm honest. And at that very second some voice seemed to whisper in my ear, 'But when you come tomorrow to make your proposal, that girl won't even see you. She'll order her coachman to kick you out of the yard. Publish it through all the town,' she would say. 'I'm not afraid of you.' I looked at the young lady. My voice had not deceived me. That is how it would be, not a doubt of it. I could see from her face, not that I should be turned out of the house. My spite was roused. I longed to play her the nastiest, swinish cad's trick, to look at her with a sneer, and on the spot where she stood before me, to stun her with a tone of voice that only a shopman could use. 4,000. What do you mean? I was joking. You've been counting your chickens too easily, madam. 200 if you like, with all my heart. But 4,000 is not a sum to throw away on such frivolity. You've put yourself out to no purpose. I should have lost the game, of course. She'd have run away. But it would have been an infernal revenge. It would have been worth it all. I'd have howled with regret all the rest of my life, only to have played that trick. Would you believe it? It has never happened to me with any other woman, not one, to look at her at such a moment with hatred. But on my oath I looked at her for 3 seconds, or 5 perhaps, with fearful hatred. That hate, which is only a hair's breadth from love, from the maddest love. Just say the maddest love. Don't say from love, comma, from the maddest love. God, this, I just want to edit this. It's so annoying. I went to the window, put my forehead against the frozen pane, the cold pane that was frozen, and I remember the ice on the frozen pane burnt my forehead like fire. Burnt my forehead like fire. It's so tautological. Let me just read that again. I went to the window, put my forehead against the frozen pane, and I remember the ice burnt my forehead like fire. How about this? I put my forehead against the frozen window pane, and the ice burnt my forehead. I put my forehead against the icy window, which burned. My forehead burned as I put it against the icy window. Just spare us 90% of your words, Dostoevsky. I did not keep her long. Don't be afraid. I turned around, went up to the table. I opened the drawer and took out a banknote for 5,000 rubles. It was lying in a French dictionary. Then I showed it her in silence, folded it, handed it to her, opened the door into the passage, and stepping back, made her a deep bow, a most respectful, a most impressive bow. Believe me. She shuddered all over, gazed at me for a second, turned horribly pale, white as a sheet, in fact, and all at once, not impetuously but softly, gently, bowed down to my feet, not a boarding school curtsy, but a Russian bow, with her forehead to the floor. She jumped up and ran away. I was wearing my sword. I drew it and nearly stabbed myself with it on the spot. Why, I don't know. It would have been frightfully stupid, of course. I suppose it was from delight. Can you understand that one might kill oneself from delight? But I didn't stab myself. I only kissed my sword and put it back in the scabbard, which there was no need to have told you, by the way. And I fancy that in telling you about my inner conflict, I have laid it on rather thick to glorify myself. But let it pass, and to hell with all who pry into the human heart. Well, so much for that adventure with Katerina Ivanovna. So now Ivan knows of it, and you, no one else. Dmitri got up, took a step or two in his excitement, pulled out his handkerchief and mopped his forehead, then sat down again, not in the same place as before, but on the opposite side, so that Alyosha had to turn quite around to face him. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. That one, you know, at least it kind of made sense to me. And there were bits of it that were pretty good. The actual anecdote where he was just talking, narrating normally, was bearable. I just cannot stand this dialogue style when it's like Dostoevsky's trying to be like edgy and put like character into the dialogue and make it like flow like human conversation where you do get excited and repeat things and say tautological sentences, and he's trying to like stylize it in that way. But God, is it tedious to write, to read. Like, I don't want to read a sentence which could be one quarter the length, where you just say the same thing in four different synonyms. And like, even a sentence like, a most respectful, I made her a deep bow, a most respectful, a most impressive bow, believe me. So can't you just say, I made her a deep and respectful bow? Why do you have to say, I made her a deep bow, full stop, a most respectful, comma, a most impressive bow, believe me. You know, it's like, the book's long enough, and like, you do that, like, you be repetitive and you draw out a sentence if it's significant and interesting, right? But if it's insignificant and uninteresting, why would you make your reader read the same thing three times in a row? For what purpose? I do not understand. I do not understand the prose in this book. It's so weird. I've read another Dostoevsky book. I've read Notes for Underground, and I don't remember any problem like this. So I don't know what's happening in this book. Maybe it's a translator thing. Anyway, you guys are probably so sick of me bitching about this book, and I'm really sorry because I wanted to be impartial for all of this whole project, all the books on this list. So, like, if I wasn't enjoying it, it wouldn't stop you from enjoying it. That was always kind of like my aim. And I know at times I've gotten frustrated with other books or whatever. But this one I've just gone like, I don't know, I've just like cracked it pretty much. I've just like given up on even trying to pretend that I'm enjoying it because it's just so tedious. It's so tedious. All right. Have your say about the book. Is anyone else finding it tedious? Am I the only one? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills here. Like, everyone else just seems to be like, oh yeah, this chapter was about this. I found it really funny or entertaining. And I'm just like, I couldn't be further away from you on that one. So I'm curious. I'm curious to learn. And also, am I ruining the book for anyone? I feel like I'm totally just shitting on this book. But I also kind of feel like this book is shitting on me, so I kind of don't care. Anyway, reddit.com/r/TheHemingwayList. I apologize for how off the rails this podcast has gone in the recent chapters. I really hope I can wrangle myself back into this book and just, like, we've got a lot of book to go here on Brothers Karamazov, and I can't be having this attitude for the whole thing. I don't see how anyone could stand listening to me rant about this book in such a way. So I've got to come around to it. I've got to calm down about it. So I will endeavor to do that. Anyway, I do thank you for listening today. I love you guys. You guys are the best. I'm sorry I'm a dick. And I'll see you tomorrow.